wouldn't necessarily think that because someone read, they would be more likely to volunteer. They would be more likely to do charity work. They would be more likely to coach Little League. They would be more likely to be part of a softball team. The correlation is so overwhelming.
That's NEA Chairman Dana Gioia, and this is Writer's Voice, where the conversation goes deeper. We talk to writers of all genres about matters that move us and make us think. And you're joining us now at our new time, 4 to 5 p.m. on WMUA. In 2004, the National Endowment for the Arts came out with a study called Reading at Risk that showed reading in America is in steep decline. In just 20 years, from 1982 to 2002, America lost some 20 million readers. Less than half of adults now read literature, and the steepest declines were in young people. That bodes well neither for writers nor for our national culture. But poet and NEA chairman Dana Gioia is doing something about it. He started a project called The Big Read. It aims to foster reading by bringing whole communities together to read one book, like Ray Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451, read by Enterprise, Oregon. I caught up with Dana Gioia in November at a memorial for his friend, poet Peter Virick, who died in May. Gioia talked with me about reading, poetry, and The Big Read. But before that, when we made the appointment for the interview, Gioia had given me Poetry Out Loud, a wonderful CD that came out of a poetry recitation competition sponsored by the NEA and the Poetry Foundation. That CD led to a remarkable experience. Just after getting the CD, I picked up a hitchhiker on the way to Amherst, something my gut instinct urged me to do when I saw him at the side of the road. He was a young guy, dressed in denims, with a buzz cut and an air about him that signaled he wasn't from the class that supplies the sons of professors. I had been playing Gioia's CD on my car's player, and I was loath to turn it off, even with a stranger in the car. My writer listened for a few stanzas, and then he asked me eagerly if I liked poetry. When I answered in the affirmative, he responded, "Me too." His next question really surprised me. He asked, "Do you like the Beat Poets, Allen Ginsberg, Jack Kerouac?" Well, I like the former. I haven't really read the latter. So I just said yes. He went on to say that he never used to read, but when he was in rehab, his girlfriend gave him a book. It was the autobiography of the lead musician of the Red Hot Chili Peppers, and the book talked about Catcher in the Rye. He said to me, "You know, I had that book. I had it from school, but I'd never read it. So I took it down and I started reading it, and I loved it. And then I found out about Howl, Allen Ginsberg Howl, and it was the best poem ever." Well, he went on this vein for the rest of the ride, and as I let him off, I thought about how reading had opened up his world. And I remembered how reading Howl, when I was about 12, opened up the world of modern poetry to me. So I shared the experience with Dana Gioia the following day as I sat down for our interview.
See, I think there's a big mistake that we make in our culture about poetry, and it's because, you know, poetry has become this type of academic study, this academic profession. But, you know, poetry is an art that should engage the majority of the population. I mean, maybe not everybody likes poetry, not everybody even likes music. But, you know, poetry has a very broad appeal, or at least the right poetry has a very broad appeal. And I think that we have lost the conviction of that, and we no longer make it fundamental in education. Because, you know, one of the things poetry does, I think, is help us recognize, articulate, and refine our emotions, our humanity. And we need to, in a sense, develop emotional capacity and emotional maturity the same way we need to develop intellectual capacity and maturity.
Well, you also talk about poetry bringing about the activism, a sense of activism, of literature, reading literature brings that about, but also how it excites the emotions.
Yeah, well, I think it's not merely exciting the emotions. That's part of it, but it's to help us recognize what we are like as human beings. And to, in a sense, awaken the fullness of our humanity. And by awakening that, you enlarge it. You enlarge maybe your sympathies. You enlarge your conceptual thought, your imagination. And then as you enlarge it, to shape it and refine it. I think Shakespeare has the same effect on young people. I mean, when kids have their first encounter with Shakespeare, for a great many of them, it's transformational. But I think also, you know, when kids read Shakespeare or see Shakespeare for the first time, they're shocked because they suddenly see a guy who not only gives you the greatest flights of human fancy, he tells wonderful dirty jokes, really stupid puns, and things like this. And they realize that all of this stuff that they experience that they find interesting, he's found a way of incorporating in his work. It isn't just some kind of solemn, abstract, verbal performance. It's a celebration of humanity. And that's fundamentally what art is a recognition and a celebration of what it means to be human.
The NEA came out with a report called Reading at Risk, which actually found that the state of reading in the United States is not a good one.
No, it's not only is the state of reading in the United States not a good one, it's catastrophic. Every 10 years, the National Endowment for the Arts does what really is the largest survey in the world on arts participation. We take 17,000 households that we match to replicate what the U.S. population is like demographically, ethnically. And we go into those houses, we interview them about all kinds of things about arts behavior, reading, civic involvement. And what we discovered was that reading is declining among every group of Americans, every age group, income group, educational level, every race, every region, both genders. So it's a catastrophic fall off among younger adults. In the last 20 years, younger adults, 18 to 35, have gone from the people who read most in society to the people who read least. And we are also, I regret to say, now producing the first generations of college graduates who do not read. And so you look at this. Now, it has at least three implications, I think. I mean, first, for literature, it's terrible. I mean, it means that the whole involvement, you know, with the written word, the literature, all the richness of human life and human thought that's encased in that is in peril. Secondly, it has tremendous repercussions across all areas of intellectual achievement. I mean, everything from as basic as will you complete high school, will you complete college, to the number one complaint now that employers have about new hires is these kids can't read, they can't write. American industry spends $5 billion a year in remedial training. But most interesting and most surprising to us was that if you look at people who read versus people who don't read, now, I don't mean illiterate versus non-illiterate. These are people that all can read in potential. But adults who choose to read versus adults who choose not to read, the readers are overwhelmingly more engaged in every aspect of civic life, volunteerism, charity work, belonging to organizations, even things as simple as exercise, that something happens for readers which awakens something in them, a better sense of their own individuality, a greater respect for other people's individuality, a greater sense of responsibility and interest to the community.
And why is that?
Well, now, first of all, let me since people don't have the numbers in front of them, let me say that we did not discover that no one reads in America. What we're seeing is that the percentage of Americans who read has been going down steadily for the last 20 years, and we're now at a point where less than half of the U.S. adult population reads. Now, we're talking about reading literature, but we define literature in such a broad way. We're not talking about James Joyce's Ulysses. You know, we're talking about almost any kind of book, any kind of poem, short story, even in a magazine, or even on the Internet.
Do you mean just fiction and poetry, or do you also include in that nonfiction?
Well, I'll do it in an organized way since we measure, the thing comes out of an arts participation study, so we measure primarily, now we have different cuts, and I'll explain that in a second. If during the last 12 months, did you read any novel, any short story, any poem, any work of dramatic, everything from a play to a screenplay, in a book, a magazine, a newspaper, on the Internet, or even if you had a poem that you keep in your wallet that you read when you're depressed, we count that. If you read one page of a Harlequin romance and give up because it's too hard, we count you. We also measure, did you read any book in the last 12 months, any book on any subject? Every measure is going down. So,
and you're saying also that it's not only going down, but it's going down at an increasing rate.
Yeah, especially among younger people. But my point is really that it's not like Americans are illiterate. The level of illiteracy in the United States has been relatively constant. It's measured by different organizations in different ways. It's about 7%. About 7% of Americans cannot read. Surprising thing is almost 7% of college graduates can't read, but we won't get into that. So you've still got a lot of good readers out there, but we've now reached an unprecedented point in American history where there are more non-readers than readers. Now, once again, I'm not talking about fanatical, everyday readers, just somebody who in the course of a year feels the impulse to pick up some book or some, you know, some magazine or whatever. And we're really in a culture where the majority of people now watch television, play video games, you know, listen, you know, go onto the internet, listen to their iPods, listen to radios.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Dana Gioia, poet and chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts. Okay, so now you said that reading is involved with civic participation as well. I wonder if you could say, why do you think that that's so? What is it about reading that engages people in a more broad way?
Well, let me say that I think at the Arts Endowment, we were all surprised to see this correlation. You know, because, you know, you wouldn't necessarily think that because someone read, they would be more likely to volunteer. They would be more likely to do charity work. They would be more likely to coach Little League. They would be more likely to be part of a softball team. Now, it's not necessarily cause and effect. It's correlative. But the correlation is so overwhelming. We're not talking about a subtle difference here. We're talking about people who read being 2 to 3 times more likely, 200-300% participation rate differences. And it makes you think that there has to be something that is really fundamental at work.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Dana Gioia, poet and director of the National Endowment for the Arts. When you say correlative versus causative, what you mean is that the people who tend to read also tend to be the people who are civically engaged.
Yes, and it could be cause and effect, or it could be something that both of these things are the effect of something else, or that these two things affect each other. But if you look at it, it makes you start to wonder, okay, well, why would a reader, because, you know, let's say you take a conventional view of a reader, I mean, somebody just sitting down reading a book, and a lot of people in American society say, well, you know, readers are escapists. They just want to get away from the world. Where this data says it's just the opposite. Readers are, for one reason or another, deeply engaged in their communities at a far better level than non-readers. What I think is going on is this. Now, this is a hypothesis. It's not, I cannot prove this statistically, although it is consistent with statistics. I think that there's something that's awakened in you at a relatively early age, if you're a reader, and that reading nourishes it. And it's a sense of, I'm a person in this world, I have a different life, I have an individual destiny, and everybody in the world is an individual. They all have an inner life, they all have their own tastes, their own destinies, and you have a much more intense sense of social and human reality. And living with a sense of your own realities, of other people's realities, I think you take more interest and more responsibility in the social fabric. So that's my theory. I mean, because think of what a novel is. What a novel is a story about another person in which you can see the inside of their brain, usually. You can see their emotions, and you live with them in their psychological reality and their social reality in the dailiness of their existence. And I think what that does is it cultivates a kind of respect for other people, and understanding of other people. I don't believe that the political progress of countries like America or England or Western Europe, which were the places in the world where liberal democracy, as we now understand it, was created, I don't believe that that political progress is inseparable from the literary cultures that these countries created, where millions of people on a daily basis read novels and short stories about other people's lives and the dailiness of their existence. It could be about a guy named Robinson Crusoe who's stranded on an island, a young girl named Clarissa who has no money and has an employer who's trying to rape her, a kid named David Copperfield whose parents are ruined and is forced to go and work 12 hours a day in a factory. And people understood from the inside the lives of people less fortunate than themselves, and that cultivated a kind of social compassion that over the next couple of centuries changed the world for the better.
You mentioned our liberal democracy, which is so rooted in the Enlightenment. I wonder if you can say something about the connection between the Enlightenment and reading. I mean, I think, for example, of the Encyclopedia of Diderot, but also the novel was born in that time.
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing, I'm a poet, so maybe I'm probably talking against my own profession here, but you know, poetry is a human universal. Every culture has poetry, and we could spend a lot of time just talking about why that seems to be the case and how it differs. The novel is a specific art form that grows out of a specific technology, which is typography, which is print. Because, you know, the novel is something that tends to be read silently by a single individual or read aloud perhaps by a father or mother to a small family. Those are the circumstances under which the novel was promulgated in the late 17th century through the present. And what the novel is different is a narrative. It tells a story just the way that Homer told a story. But almost immediately something happens differently in the novel, which is rather than tell the story of kings or queens or military heroes, it tends to start talking about everyday life in a way that's often centered in the middle class. And it tends to have the middle class going downward into the working classes or the middle class in trollop maybe going up into the aristocracy. But it's a fundamentally a middle class art form. Now, some people said that one of the reasons that they wanted the novel, the middle class wanted the novel, was that the world had grown so complicated that the novel allowed them to see the inside of other people's houses. I think what it really did was allowed them to see the inside of other people's brains. You know, that you could, if you were a middle class woman, you could read about the criminal slums, you could read about the aristocracy in the novel, and it showed you what the world was like. Now, you can say, well, it showed you badly, it lied to you, it misrepresented it. I don't think that matters as much as the daily imaginative exercise of and think about this. If you have a million people in a country as a daily imaginative exercise, imagining the lives of other people, other genders, other classes, other professions, other races, from the inside, how transformative that is to humanity.
And also to see into your own brain and by reflection, I think, for example, of Madame Bovary. So it works both ways.
Well, it does. I mean, perhaps the best way for a man to understand a woman is to read some of the great novels by women. The best way for a woman to understand a man is to read great novels. I mean, I know for me, the first time I read a Chinua Achebe novel, the great Nigerian novelist, I read Things Fall Apart, I was just flabbergasted. I had no idea that that's what Nigeria was like. That's what a kid from a village coming to the big city would be like. And I read all of Achebe's novels, and it's given me a sense of Africa that I could never have gotten, I think, from political books or sociological books.
You put me in mind a recent interview. We interviewed Francine Prose about her book, Reading Like a Writer. Mm-hmm. And she talks about teaching in a college in Utah, a Mormon college in Utah. It was extremely religious, in a rather narrow way, a religious community. And these were all white kids. And she had them read Kleist's The Marquise Fanot. And she wasn't quite sure they would like it. The language is fairly complex, and it's certainly of a time and place that they're not used to. And they loved it. She came into class the day they were to discuss it. And as she neared the classroom, she heard them all excitingly talking about the novella as if the characters were people that they knew themselves.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, as chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts, one of the most important things that I've insisted on while I'm there is not to condescend to Americans, to bring the very best in the arts to the broadest audience possible. We do not need a government agency in the arts to bring mediocrity to millions. I mean, the purpose should be to create an encounter with real art. You know, I'm a working-class kid from L.A. You know, my dad's Sicilian, my mom's Mexican. I'm the first person in my family ever to go to college. And I was raised in a really rough neighborhood. If you've ever seen Pulp Fiction or Jackie Brown, the two Quentin Tarantino films, those are filmed in the neighborhood I was born and grew up in. And I remember many, many stories about the power of literature, but I'll give you an interesting one, which is that you know what a lowrider is, you know, like a cruiser, a guy who has like a car that he lowers the front wheels and drives around, a you know, gang member. And there was a guy I know who was a lowrider, and I don't know how it happened, but for some reason, he read Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment. He somehow heard about it, and it changed his life because he realized that he was Raskolnikov. You know, he had not killed, you know, a pawnbroker, but that was his life. He had this alienation, and he had all this violence, and he began reading through Dostoevsky. Then Dostoevsky was supposed to be like Kafka, so he read through Kafka. And this guy not only has put his life together, he ended up going to college and actually having a career. One of the few people in my high school that actually made it through college. And it was in a funny way because he read a book that anybody would say, oh, this kid would never like Dostoevsky. You're crazy, a lowrider reading Dostoevsky. But for him, for whatever series of accidents, which I played no part in, I should say, it changed his life. And I think that what we're trying to do at the Arts Endowment, what writers should try to do is to give people the possibilities of transformation. Sometimes it's a huge transformation. Sometimes it's a tiny transformation. But, you know, our lives should constantly be transformative. We should constantly try to transcend who we are towards something better, more capacious, more humane, more active. And I don't see how we can do that without literature. And a society in which literature is being replaced, and pardon me, I know this will sound snobbish, by commercial electronic entertainment, I think is one that's dangerous because I love entertainment, but what entertainment does is give you a predictable pleasure. It can be, you know, the pleasure of thrills and excitement. It can be the pleasures of you know, a kind of sentimental romance. It can be, the, you know, but it's designed to have the same person leave as entered, where literature at least opens up the possibility of transformation. Now, obviously the best films do this, but most films don't even try.
We're talking with Dana Gioia of the National Endowment for the Arts.
You talk in some of the literature that you gave me about the program, The Big Read. You say in that art is not escapism, but an invitation to activism. Is that the distinction that you're drawing here between entertainment and literature?
When I made the statement that art is not escapism, it's an invitation to activism, I was actually referring specifically to the statistics we have about the correlation between arts participation and all kinds of social engagement. I mean, it's a fact. It's not an opinion. It is a fact. And we see this happening a lot where I think in our culture, you know, see, American culture is a, you know, I'm an American, I love America, but there is a Philistine side to American culture, an anti-intellectual side to American culture. And I think they look on, well, why, you know, why do you want to read, kid? You know, go out and do something. You know, why do you want? And there's a kind of prejudice that somehow reflective activities of the imagination are somehow not productive. It probably comes back to the time when you weren't out doing the harvest with the rest of the family because you were reading a book. But the fact is now people are much more likely to come down, sit in front of a TV and just watch TV and do nothing except perhaps eat than go out and actually do some kind of activity. I mean, one of the most interesting statistics we've come across is that the amount of TV the average American watches is the same as it was 20 or 30 years ago. Except now they also play video games, they have an internet, they have an iPod, they have all these other forms of electronic entertainment. What has changed in their life? The time they spend with other human beings and the time they spend reading. And you think about that, I mean, the time they spend with other human beings, I mean, it's really pretty scary. The basic fabric of social interaction, the family, friends, organizations. Most people used to belong to groups. You know, it could be a bowling league, it could be a volunteer club, it could be a church group, it could be a reading group, or you know, whatever. It could be the Kiwanis Club. All those forms of socialization are decaying.
Yeah, and You know, what I'm struck with in what you say is a concept of the passivity that people have. I mean, to watch TV is a passive.
Yeah. A comfortable, activity. It's a very comfortable kind of passivity. I mean, that's what's happened is we've made it extraordinarily comfortable and soothing to do nothing. And I don't mean to condescend because readers, myself included, do all of these activities. They do every one of these activities, you know, video games and everything else. I don't play video games, but everything else I do. The question is, do you balance them as part of an overall schedule? And I think a lot of Americans have lost the ability to ration them, to balance them, and they just kind of do them compulsively. Now, once again, I don't want to sound like a snob because I don't believe that there's like these great people that do all this and these bad people that don't. But I do have a public responsibility now to try to understand the role of the arts in America and try to create programs to encourage the best behavior. And here's what I think happens when you read, and I'll compare it to playing a video game. I mean, a video game is very exciting. In fact, judging from the fact that I have two teenage sons, I think it is mildly addictive. You get a kind of an adrenaline rush. But when you're reading, you have to have focused, linear attention. Secondly, when you read, you have to make pictures in your mind. You make those pictures in your mind in two ways. One, from your memory, your stock of personal memories, and secondly, from your imagination. And so you think about what reading is. It's an ability to focus and to concentrate. Those are the same kinds of mental skills that you use in mathematics, in music, I think also in life, if you really want to pay attention to another person. Mm-hmm. And you train your imagination and memory. In electronic entertainment, they give you the images, so your passive receptor of the images, which may or may not have anything to do, you know, with your own memory, and it tends to color your imagination rather than I think in some ways expand it. And then finally, in something like a video game, they have these flashing lights and explosions and sound effects. I mean, every second. And it's essentially to keep you stimulated so that you can almost relax into it. I mean, it's a funny way. I mean, it's a different kind of attention. You know, it's an attention that's provoked, you know, rather than elicited. And the same thing with film. The film actually gives you the pacing. You know, it just carries you along. So I don't know. I mean, I think that there should be room in a life for all of these things. But if you don't, in a sense, somehow develop your own internal capabilities, especially at a younger age, you may never do that.
So let's move from the dire state of reading in America to what the NEA is doing about it. You have a program called The Big Read. Say what it is and what it hopes to do.
Well, actually, you know, the NEA has begun what we believe is going to be probably the largest literary program in the history of the federal government. We've just announced 72 cities. And I will issue a challenge. Not one of them is from Massachusetts. Massachusetts, listen and apply. What we do is we give funding to communities to create a specific kind of a focused reading program. And now let me tell you what we do. We try to get a community. Now, this community can be everything from a small town to a whole metro area to read a book together. We want the library, the schools, the mayor, the Chamber of Commerce, the radio station, the newspaper to apply together as a community. We want them to bring us a partnership within the community. What we then do is give the community a cash grant, but we also give them television and radio program about the book. We give them a beautiful 24-page color booklet that if they want 10,000, 100,000 copies so that every school kid, every library patron, every bookstore customer, every book club member, every member of a retirement community can have a copy of a little booklet about this book. And then for about a month, we celebrate that book. Now, let me give you an example. What do we mean? Let's say we take a book like The Great Gatsby. And in a community, we customarily have about 100 and 150 partners. And so we'll have every branch, every high school, every branch of every library. We'll have companies. We'll have businesses. We'll have foundations. Sometimes we'll have 35 retirement communities. And every one of them does something to celebrate the book. So with The Great Gatsby, we might begin the whole program with an antique car rally. Then we have a great Gatsby party. Then we bring a biographer of Fitzgerald in to give a lecture. But we also have every high school, you know, class that's doing it do a project, and they'll perform the project either at the high school or, you know, at the library. We'll have readers' clubs doing this thing. And we're designing it so that there's not one way to read the book. There's not one way to respond to the book. But we elicit every branch of the community to talk about it in their own way. We have these beautifully produced radio shows that are broadcast on radio. You know, we have some cases the newspaper might get the rights to serialize the book in the newspaper. Bookstores display it. You know, you have discussion groups. And what we hope happens is one of two things individually and one thing socially. We hope that you either read the book or you feel guilty you didn't. I think guilt can be positive in such cases because maybe you'll pick it up later. Maybe you'll actually get into a conversation with somebody, you know, so you can find out about the book. And socially what we want is we want the community to begin to think of itself as a place where books matter, where reading matters, where arts matter. You know, a community will define itself as like we're the town that used to have a mill and now we're depressed. We're a town with a crime problem. Communities are always defining themselves, and it's usually in negative ways. We want a community to define itself in a positive way, like saying, hey, you know, we're the community that everybody got together and read The Sun Also Rises, or we're the place that read, you know, their eyes were watching God. And I think that has a potential of really positive effect, as well as taking public institutions like libraries and reaffirming their role as the positive shapers of communities.
Dana Gioia of the National Endowment for the Arts. Stay tuned for more of our interview after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking to poet Dana Gioia of the National Endowment for the Arts. We're talking about the NEA project, The Big Read. It gets whole communities together to read one book.
Talk about some of the places where this has happened. You have Enterprise, Oregon.
When we tested it first in 10 pilot cities, and they went from 1,103 people, which was Enterprise, Oregon, to 4 million in Miami-Dade County, where we did it bilingually. We have an ever-lengthening list of books for communities to choose from. We started off with four books. The two most popular books in reading programs like this, Ray Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451 and Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird. We added Zora Neale Hurston's Their Eyes Were Watching God and The Great Gatsby by Scott Fitzgerald. And then we've added, you know, eight more books. We have Grapes of Wrath by John Steinbeck. We have A Farewell to Arms by Ernest Hemingway. We have Joy Luck Club by Amy Tan. We have Age of Innocence by Edith Wharton. We have My Antonia by Willa Cather, which is a book I adore. We have Bless Me Ultima by Rodolfo Anaya. We have The Heart is a Lonely Hunter by Carson McCullers. And the 12th book is The Maltese Falcon by Dashiell Hammett. And we have books like Fahrenheit 451 and The Maltese Falcon because we want to say, hey, it's great to read mysteries. It's great to read science fiction. It's great to read romances. It's great to read the whole variety of books. And what we'll be doing is we'll be adding about 10 additional books a year. So the community can choose the book they want from this ever-growing list. And there's these incredible materials that are put together. I mean, we have these shows that are put together that no community, not even a major city like Chicago, could afford to do. And we're, you know, but if you can do them once for the country and make them available free everywhere.
Now, you've likened this project to the WPA. The Works Progress Administration that was started by Franklin Delano Roosevelt during the Great Depression as part of the New Deal.
I mean, the WPA struck me as an incredible moment in American cultural history. People were out of work, and among the people that were out of work were artists. And so, I mean, what we try to do at the NEA, I mean, a good example is our Shakespeare program. We've given employment to 2,000 actors in 60 theater companies to tour. They've already been to 1,300 cities. They're mostly small and mid-sized communities, a lot of them rural, and they bring new productions of Shakespeare. The local people can buy tickets, but more important, we bring high school students in for free so they can actually see a play of Shakespeare, and we coordinate with the school, so the school assigns that play.
So you're saying that your WPA ideas are more than just the big read.
Yes, all of our national initiatives, and we have one in jazz, we have one in Shakespeare, mm-hmm. we have one in the visual arts, we have, you know, one in dance. I mean, it really come out of there, which is to say this country has enormous cultural and educational needs. The National Endowment for the Arts is the only organization in the U.S. that supports all of the arts and arts education in all of the states and jurisdictions. And we have this unique role, and because we're an independent public, you know, entity, we have a kind of public credibility, and we have to think big. We have to think ambitiously.
This came out of the New Deal. The WPA came out of the New Deal, and that was a time when the concept of the role of government was very different than the one that holds sway today. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what's happened to funding of the arts, to even funding of the NEA, and how the role of smaller government plays out in terms of this.
Well, so I would maintain, and I don't really want to get into politics too much, that while the rhetoric of government may be different right now, that the government's never been bigger than it is now. So, you know, so it's we may be talking about positioning rather than actuality. But, you know, it's no secret that the National Endowment for the Arts has had a dramatic history. And during the late 80s and the entire 90s, the agency became really one of the focal points of the culture wars. Mm-hmm. The NEA 10 years ago was almost entirely shut down. And it was really came within a couple of votes of being abolished. The budget was cut in half. Half the people were fired. The programs were curtailed. And even when I became chairman, which was 4 years ago, the endowment was under constant attack. It would be about 125 members of Congress that voted to eliminate it every month. The press may have been vaguely sympathetic, but there were two versions of the NEA. The right looked on the NEA as the purveyors of smut and blasphemy, and the left looked on the NEA as the lovable but inept purveyors of smut and blasphemy. You know, I mean, it was just this kind of, it was a kind of cultural joke. I mean, I really do think that we had become that. And so when I became chairman, I mean, I realized there was a huge public perception issue. And I made the decision, which was against all expert opinion at that point, to simply turn our back on history and simply be unapologetic about our mission, be ambitious about the scope of things, and to reaffirm why the agency was begun to begin with. And I think that the reason that the NEA was created in the Great Society period was the recognition that creativity and the arts played a fundamental role in a free society. Mm-hmm. And this is not a mission that you should apologize for. Now, we did have to do a better job of explaining what we were to the American people. I mean, the old NEA, I think, was very lax in trying to explain itself, and consequently, it put itself in a situation where for 20 years, it let the critics of arts funding dictate the public conversation. So we had to, in a sense, take over the public conversation. Now, you can do this intellectually, or you can do it, dare I say, existentially. And I believe that you do it by action. So just when everybody's saying, well, what are you going to do, keep a low profile, don't do anything, stay out of the public thing, we created Shakespeare in American Communities, which is the Shakespeare program. And it was a simple vision, which is to take the best art possible and bring it to the broadest audience possible. And so we started off at that point with 6 theater companies touring all 50 states. And then we did something that I think surprised everybody. I was able to convince the Department of Defense to give us $1 million to bring a 7th company in to tour military bases. And it was sort of funny. I mean, people in the theater community say, well, why are you doing that? The military people, they don't like Shakespeare. And I said, you know, don't you think that's a failure of imagination? I mean, these people, how do we know? They don't get a chance to see it. And we had huge crowds. These military, I mean, because you have to think about military families now. You know, people are older, they have kids. And so people were able to bring their families to these things. We had these huge success with it. And the program was so successful, we built on it and we've built on it. And we now have, you know, had 60 companies that have been involved. We've gone from being in 100 cities, we've now been in 1,300 cities.
So what's been the response on the Hill?
Well, I'm happy to say that over the last 4 years, we have been able to raise the budget every year. We now have a bipartisan majority in both houses. And our budget increases are now actually, when we first came there, whenever we'd get a budget increase, people would talk against us. Now, the last year, our budget increase was passed by a voice vote with not a single person speaking in opposition to us, which doesn't mean that there aren't still people that don't like us, but it means that they understand that in the press, with the American public, and with Congress, you know, we've done such a good job of bringing major programs of indisputable merit to the broadest audience possible, you really have no purchase from which to criticize us that has any traction.
Now, you mentioned before that the NEA had been charged with purveying smut to the American people. What about funding and supporting some of the more controversial works? I'm not really talking about smut per se, but, you know, we live in very polarized times. And so I'm wondering if there's been any price to be paid in this increasing popularity by cutting some of the things that might be more politically difficult.
Well, in a funny way, I think the NEA 8 years ago was more caught up in that because all it could do was retreat, you know, and it had to sort of, you know, oh, my God, let's avoid any controversy, where I don't believe, I don't ever fund a work because it's controversial. I don't ever not fund it because it's controversial. We fund on artistic excellence. We have 2,000 basic grants in addition to these national initiatives. And we've been able to do this really through increased appropriations, but also through public partnerships and through private partnerships. I'll give you an example. The Shakespeare program was so impressive that the Department of Justice has given us money for after-school theater programs because we could demonstrate how this thing made a difference in kids' lives, how you can take this and work with at-risk kids to have theater programs after school, which keeps them out of trouble, which develops their linguistic ability, which creates positive forms of socialization, which reinforces their schoolwork. You know, we have the Department of Defense that brought us to Shakespeare. Boeing has given us money to do writing workshops among military, and they even give us money to tour, and I'm not making this up, 24 opera companies through military bases. Mm. And people said, opera companies to the military? We had packed houses. These people are starved for art. People are starved for beauty.
So what has been, if you could isolate one really most exciting moment for you in this, or idea that came to you, what would that be?
Well, I'll tell you the thing that I think is probably most moving was maybe our opening of our Shakespeare program, because we got this big theater in New London, Connecticut. We thought New London, Connecticut would be a great place symbolically to have it because it's, you know, New London, Shakespeare's from London, and it's also, you know, where Eugene O'Neill, the greatest American dramatist, you know, spent his childhood. So we had this big theater, and I looked at it, and I said, well, how many seats do we sell? And they said, well, you know, they still got empty seats. And so and the Coast Guard Academy was there. So I went to the Coast Guard Academy. I said, well, we will give two free tickets to anybody who comes to this in your uniform, and you can bring a date. I figured they were free tickets. I found a legal way of making that fundable. So I had this great audience. The audience was in thirds. I had one third, which is I call the NPR crowd. It's people like you and me who go to the theater, go to museums. They tend to be a little bit older, affluent, educated, white. And they're there. Hey, this is the core audience for the American arts, so we don't make fun of it. So they're there. So maybe 600 of them, there's about 600 high school kids. And the NPR crowd and high school kids are never in the same audience. And they like it. They just love the fact that they're there. And there's still some empty seats. And suddenly about 5 minutes before the performance, all of these Coast Guard guys and gals come in their dress uniforms. And they're sort of scattered around the audience. And if the NPR crowd is not used to seeing, you know, the high school kids in a Shakespeare performance, they're not used to seeing the Coast Guard in uniform. And it was wonderful, and they were all happy to be together. And we had this packed house, this fantastic performance of Othello by the Aquila Theater. And I think what we did in New London and then in 1,300 other American communities is that we brought parts of the community together around art that aren't used to being in the same room at the same time. And we've been transformative not only in bringing art there, but building the community.
Dana Gioia, Chairman of the National Endowment for the Arts. He's also a poet. His most recent volume of poetry, Interrogations at Noon, won the National Book Award. You can find links to his poetry at our website, writersvoice.net. As I mentioned at the beginning of the show, Gioia gave me the CD Poetry Out Loud, put out by the NEA and the Poetry Foundation. Here's actor Alfred Molina reading Dylan Thomas's Elegy to his father. Do not go gentle into that good night.
Do not go gentle into that good night. Old age should burn and rave at close of day. Rage, rage against the dying of the light. Though wise men at their end know dark is right, because their words had forked no lightning, they do not go gentle into that good night. Good men, the last wave by, crying how bright their frail deeds might have danced in a green bay, rage, rage against the dying of the light. Wild men who caught and sang the sun in flight and learned too late, they grieved it on its way, do not go gentle into that good night. Grave men near death, who see with blinding sight, blind eyes could blaze like meteors and be gay, rage, rage against the dying of the light. And you, my father, there on the sad height, curse, bless me now with your fierce tears, I pray. Do not go gentle into that good night. Rage, rage against the dying of the light.
Well, 2006 is going gently into that good night. A few years ago, I was fortunate to spend New Year's Day in a tiny village in the hilly backcountry of Provence, where I'd gone to live for the better part of a year. It was a time of new beginnings. For one, it was the inauguration of the euro, but also a time for reflections on the past. Here's a section from my memoir, Province of the Heart. The French word for New Year's is Jour de l'An, or Day of the Year in literal translation. Here's Jour de l'An by your host here on Writer's Voice. January 1st, 2002. After many hours at the keyboard, a stretch turns into the realization that I must take a walk, move, breathe the bright cold air of the day. Outside, it's not as cold as I'd thought. The air has that limpid purity that I love so well here, and the sun takes the edge off the chill. Walking up the long path through the village, I pass Madame Pascal's grocery, closed but not shuttered. I have the feeling that if I knock on the door, she would come, slowly as always, ducking through the narrow passage that leads from her home to the interior of the store, with a little dip to her walk, thrusting her hands deep into the pockets of her blue cardigan, and say, "Bonjour, madame." And as today is New Year, she would add, "Bonne année." Past the tiny café that's only open on Saturdays, and then only for a few hours, past the ancient church with a single, small stained glass window set into its side like a jewel, I come to the village square with its broken public phone and its World War I monument. Such markers can be found in nearly every village in France. Three sides of the ugly obelisk are blank under their battle site headings, Somme, Marne, and L'Isère. But the fourth, Verdun, has 13 names on it, far too many for such a humble community. To my right, some children play a pickup game of soccer. To my left, a group of older men play a game of pétanque. I'm reminded of the games just like it I've seen played on the Houston Street median strip in New York's Little Italy. All the men look alike, short, stocky, bundled up against the cold with caps pulled low on their foreheads, a genotype stemming from the ancient Ligurians who first settled this land. I watch as one man lobs the ball fairly near the goal. Then he lobs another, which falls short of the first. "Putain," I hear him mutter as I turn away. I continue up through the otherwise empty village, through the quiet peace of a crisp New Year's day. Passing out of the village now, I mount the stony path leading to a high lavender field, past the meadows that were thick with mushroom hunters just 2 months ago, but are now deserted, save for the occasional flock of sheep. I listen for the plaintive sound of their bells, so familiar to my walks. But today all is silence. Only the hills call me with their siren song. The thought comes, I love it here because the landscape possesses a peace and clarity that I often find lacking in myself. Pacing one edge of the field, I glance upward to the spot across the valley that my friend Fabienne pointed out to me the first time I visited her. Her lover Olivier died there 4 years ago. Rumors circulate that he committed suicide, but she fiercely denies them. Stories come quick here. Intimate revelations are made so easily to me, a stranger. But there are always layers that remain hidden, pieces missing. A friend recently filled in more of the tale, that Fabienne's lover was married, and he and his wife lived in the same little village. The affair sowed a bitter harvest of side-taking that shook the community. There were those who condemned the liaison for breaking up Olivier's family, others who defended the primacy of love. But there was yet another twist to the story. Fabienne's lover had been a visionary, a pioneer of sustainable forestry, a regional mover and shaker. Some people he moved, others he shook. Some, those who exploited the land the easy way, clear-cutting stands of forest, saw her lover as an adversary. Their handiwork is visible everywhere, leaving great slashes pockmarked with forlorn stumps of trees in the body of the hills. Where they exploited the earth, he stewarded it, and they hated him for it. I think back to an earlier walk. Fabienne had suggested I visit the old stone sheepfold that Olivier had restored. It became a haven for hikers and sheep alike, nestled in the midst of the old-growth forest he owned and husbanded. I trudged for what seemed like hours up the mountain road. It was pitched at an ungodly steep angle. At first I passed right by the sheepfold, so hidden was it by the sheltering trees. I came to another one at the top of the mountain, this one quite ruined. Its roof of mortarless stones was all fallen in, save for several lithic ribs that still arched from wall to wall. Far below and wide stretched the entire panorama of Haute-Provence, all the way to the Luberon Mountain and over to Forcalquier and the Pre-Alps rising above the Durance River. Cutting down from the Alps toward the ocean, the river was a broad channel of light gray gravel bisected by a turquoise stream of water. The Alps drew a crisp, jagged edge across the horizon, and far to the south I imagined I could even glimpse the faint twinkle of the sea. From my perch, I could also see the broad clear cuts that scarred the nearby hillsides. The trees will suddenly become much bigger, Fabienne had told me, so I would recognize the beginning of Olivier's realm. On the way back down the mountain road, I spied a vestigial path, lightly treading the edge between an overgrown field and a wood filled with birches of enormous girth. Their smooth trunks rose from roots that writhed like nests of gigantic snakes. I felt I was gazing into Pan's country, as the native writer Jean Giono called it. On a hunch, I turned onto the weedy trail. Just beyond the far border of the field, a ghostly shape reared to view in the arboreal gloom, its flat white stones fairly glowing in the afternoon sun. The dark open mouth of its long tunnel gaped as if in surprise at my sudden appearance. I had found Olivier's sheepfold. Inside, a thick layer of wind-blown leaves flooded the floor. Branches and twigs broke the surface. Dampness exhaled a musty breath from the walls. In the adjacent hut, a broken window and latchless door afforded entrance to animals, the weather, and passing humans. These had left behind the evidence of their tenure. Piles of nutshells, droppings, rusty cans, empty wine bottles, scraps of clothing, a cheap sleeping bag dulled by filth. The sad air of neglect that clung to every surface deflated my plans to spend the night. Olivier's spirit had long ago decamped from this space. One night, after having too much to drink, Olivier took his tractor out on the gravel road that curves up and around the mountain overlooking his village. He stopped the hulking vehicle where a turnaround juts precariously over the friable hillside. Whether he came too close to the edge by accident or on purpose is unknowable and perhaps unimportant. The tractor tumbled from the precipice, spilling him out, and he died under its treads. At first, the local police suspected murder, motivated by the personal and political controversies that surrounded him. Maybe it was a local forester who resented the changes that Olivier was trying to bring about. Maybe it was a vengeful relative of his wife's. Those theories were soon ruled out, to be succeeded by rumors of suicide. His enemies longed to discover a lesson of comeuppance in his death. Others sought to find comfort in the purposeful nature of the act, no matter how anguished. That tragedy can happen for no good reason at all is something people are reluctant to acknowledge. But the truth of Olivier's death will never be known for sure. These thoughts rattling around in my head, I turn around and start back home. As I pass once more through the village square, I notice that the pétanque players have reversed the direction of their play. Another round. A player lobs one of the heavy iron balls, then mutters, "Merde." The sun is low on the horizon now, although I'm gladdened to remember that the days have begun to lengthen. Hues grow deeper, more golden. Shadows more sharply defined. The tree's silhouettes are black against the still blue sky as I open the door to the kitchen and enter its cave-like darkness. Well, that's it this week for Writer's Voice. Please join us next week in the new year when we talk with Eve Ensler of the Vagina Monologues. She talks about her new book, Insecure at Last. Also, socially responsible capitalist Peter Barnes tells us about Capitalism 3.0. Missed part of the show or just want to hear it again? Well, take our podcast with you. You'll find it at our website, writersvoice.net. And you can click on our calendar there to find out what's coming up later in the season on the show. Until next week, I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon, and Happy New Year!